This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. We thank you for listening. And today we're talking about your money, your income. Several states are increasing their minimum wage starting January 1st. What will that mean for the workers earning that minimum wage? We want to know, what do you do to get by in today's economy? What does it take to live comfortably?
My name's Denise. I'm calling from Charlestown, Indiana. I think it takes education, hard work, but most importantly, it takes the inner will to succeed.
This is Jean Marie Rose from New Philadelphia, Ohio. We have tried hard work and education, so it must be a trust fund because we are always struggling to make ends meet, mostly due to medical bills.
Give us your strategies for making it. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll be taking a closer look at what life is like for Americans trying to get by on the minimum wage a little later in the show. But first, the other end of the income scale, the extreme other end, the 0.01% of Americans who've had great success in business or investing or that trust fund inheritance. Many of them are also remaking the tax system in their own interest to save millions of dollars every year. It's the subject of a new investigation by Noam Scheiber, labor and workplace reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And Noam joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Let's start with the bottom line, Noam. How has the effective tax rate changed for the ultra wealthy over the last 30 years? What are they paying?
Yeah, well, if you look at the top 400 income earners in the country, which the IRS actually tracks and publishes data on their average tax rate, it was in the mid to upper 20s in the early 1990s, then dropped 10 years later to the low 20s. And in 2012, the last year for which we have data, it was under 17%. And by comparison, if you look at a taxpayer making about $100,000 a year in that same year, and you added in payroll taxes for both, they would be roughly equivalent. They would both pay roughly the same average tax rate.
Now, that's not, as I understand it, because the tax law has changed to say 400 wealthiest families, you get to pay less now for the most part. It's mostly because of a lot of creative and expensive navigation and mining of the tax code. Is that right?
Yeah, it's really two things. It's policy, and in particular, two big changes. In the late 90s, Bill Clinton signed legislation that lowered the capital gains tax rate, and then George W. Bush did that again in the early 2000s. And much of the income that the ultra-wealthy earn is in the form of capital gains. So that was a huge tax cut for the ultra-wealthy. But that's only part of the story. The other story is what you allude to, which is kind of gaming the system. And what the wealthy and their tax advisors and estate planners spend a lot of time and resources doing is essentially converting a lot of other types of income that would be taxed at a much higher rate into that low capital gains rate. So the change in policy is both helpful to them in itself because they do have a lot of capital gains, and it's also the basis for a enormous amount of tax schemery. and this conversion idea is very much at the center of it, and they are very much expert in exploiting that.
All right, so let's be clear. The capital gains rate that you describe is just a much lower tax rate, money that you make on investments, than normal income, the income tax that we all paid, even if it says on paper that the ultra wealthy pay, I don't know what it is, 45% rate or a 39% rate, that capital gains rate is much, much lower. And that's why you want to get there if you have that kind of money. Now, you've reported on a bunch of different ways, methods, you might call them expensive tricks, I suppose, that some of these ultra wealthy families are using to get to that lower rate. One is called the family office. This isn't like setting up a home office with a printer and a laptop computer. It's something different.
It is not. That's right. And actually, the family office is less the strategy than the means of planning the strategy. So a family office is essentially the personal wealth management arm of a very, very rich family. You have contained within that institution people who manage your investments, people who manage your philanthropic contributions, and people who manage your tax liabilities. it's very helpful to have all these things intersect in one office because they all have implications for one another. So if you're managing the investments, it's a good idea to think about the tax implications of those investments. And just to give one example that we use in the piece, if you are investing in a hedge fund and you invest directly in that hedge fund, you are going to have a lot of gains that are going to be taxed at the ordinary income rate, 43.4% after the Affordable Care Act. So it's going to be taxed at around 40% if you invest directly in a hedge fund. However, if you invest that money in an insurance company based in Bermuda, and that insurance company then invests in the hedge fund, you roughly cut in half your tax rate on those gains. So if you're a family office executive and you're trying to plan the most tax-efficient investment strategy, it is very helpful for you to know that such loopholes exist, and that's exactly what goes on in these offices.
So I got to get myself a reinsurance company in Bermuda. That's all I have to do, right?
That's exactly what you need.
Right. So, I mean, but I'm making a joke, but the point here is not that these activities are necessarily illegal. It's that they're so arcane and so expensive to achieve and find out that nobody but these families can afford the phalanx of lawyers and specialists to do it.
That's exactly right. Yes, many of them are very much in plain view. They're absolutely unassailable legally. They just require two things: incredibly sophisticated legal and estate planning advice to suss them out in the first place, and then a lot of money. They're like a very large transaction cost. So unless you have hundreds of millions of dollars, it doesn't make sense for you to spend a few million dollars setting up a transaction like this. On the other hand, if you do have hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, then the couple million dollars it takes to set it up is really, you know, it's just the cost of business.
And also the cost of business to fight and negotiate with the IRS if they turn a sideways eye at some of these activities. What is the IRS doing with some of these family offices and Bermuda partnerships? Do they look askance at it? And what happens when you turn your phalanx of lawyers on them?
Yes. So certainly in the last 5-6 years, the IRS has felt that it's very important to scrutinize high net worth individuals. In 2009, they began a special task force to aggressively scrutinize the tax returns of taxpayers with over $10 million a year in earnings. And, you know, that program has produced something. You know, it's they've managed to claw back some revenue that otherwise would have gone either unreported or unpaid to the government. But funding shortages have just really undermined these efforts. The IRS, in real dollar terms, the IRS budget has fallen over $2.5 billion in the past 5 years, which is about 20%. And these efforts to scrutinize the tax returns of the ultra wealthy are just so expensive and so resource intensive. I mean, there are just teams of accountants and lawyers and forensic, you know, investigators that have to be assigned to these teams and to these tax returns. And unless you have the full complement of personnel, it's almost impossible. I mean, it's almost impossible to suss it out, even if you do have the full complement of personnel. But if you don't, it's utterly hopeless.
All right, Noam Chaibari, let's talk about Congress, because only Congress can change these rules. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and others have been promising to try for some kind of tax reform, some reform of the tax code. And it could take many different forms. They talk about closing loopholes and flattening out the tax rate. We hear that all the time. But set the scene. How big is the army of lawyers and lobbyists that swoops in around the committee room to preserve these types of maneuvers if that negotiation starts?
It's enormous. Just if you just look at, you know, the leading hedge fund industry group and the leading private equity fund industry group, they both spend several million dollars a year in lobbying. And that's, you know, I mean, that's just one corner of this. The biggest loophole of all, as we said at the outset, is really the capital gains preference. Taxing capital gains at a substantially lower rate, it both has a direct effect in lowering the rate. And it's just the foundation for all these other loopholes. And unless they're going to get, you know, kind of focus on that, which I think is unlikely, we're really tinkering at the margins.
A wide, wide range of loopholes, rabbit holes, and tricks that the ultra wealthy use to lower their taxes. It's not illegal, but only they can afford the key. Noam Chaibari, labor and workplace reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And lots of you are talking about what it takes to live comfortably in America today. From Anoka, Minnesota, money and connections can give someone a bigger step up than hard work will ever pay out. Education is the great equalizer for young people, with one big caveat: as long as it doesn't saddle them with debt.
My name is Angelina, and I'm calling from Ashland, Oregon. I think to live comfortably in the United States, it takes family support, not necessarily financial, but emotional support and the giving of time.
Hi, this is Carl Marking from Coatesville, Pennsylvania. I think it takes hard work, drive, luck, patience, and a reasonable definition of comfortably.
From Chicago, Illinois, what does it take to make it a miracle? The American dream is a myth, and economists worldwide produce evidence to support that throughout the 1900s to the present. Very few percentile of Americans have found upward mobility through the classes. We're just as class segregated as India. If you're born into poverty here, a 90% chance you'll stay there. How is that achieving the American dream? And middle class, how can you support a family of three on $30,000 and still have a car and a college education for your child and a home? You can't.
I'm Kaylee from Buffalo, New York. I think that it takes an education. Knowing the way that the system works with and against you is key. And using that knowledge to acquire what you need to be comfortable with based on what comfortable means to you.
Hi, this is Chris Page from Winooski, Vermont. And to live comfortably in the United States, it takes education with a plan and then hard work from then on. The current model of throwing high school students into college with all of those doors wide open can be extremely damaging in that it has left a lot of young people with dead-end degrees. It's important to have some kind of vision before spending $100,000 or more on what may only amount to a wall decoration.
And from Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, how to make it to be born a white male into a wealthy family. We always want to hear from you. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.